Jamie shrugs, like that's above his pay grade.
Just call the prosecutor's office. Tell them we need it ASAP.
When Jamie's gone, I catch my breath, my eyes dancing over the memos on my desk. Mrs. Kingsbury called again about her neighbor's chainsaw going all day. He's clearing some trees, the message says, the scribblings from the dispatcher on a blue sheet of paper. Mr. Frankel, the owner of the pet supply store, someone stole the bird feeder he'd left outside for display. I told him last year to bring it inside at night. East Bay is a quaint town, but that doesn't mean people won't steal stuff if you make it easy for them. I can't deal with any of this right now. Elbows on the desk, I press my face into my open palms and hear the opposing arguments play in my head. Is there a connection between Peter's death and Eve's 15 years ago? Or is this just a small town where people have known each other for years? Am I hamstringing it? Feeding my obsession with Eve's case so I have a reason to keep it open? My mother, Rob, the shrink, even Lisa Calder. That's what they think. And Renee Walsh, what if she's deflecting suspicion? She could have done those searches herself. What she showed me was from their shared desktop. And the photos, she knew I'd be thrown when I saw Rob in them. Even her story about the boat. How do I even know that's true? Peter Walsh's parents are dead, but he has a sister. She's flying in from Dallas to go to the funeral next week. She might know. Another task to complete, maybe the first one, before the other witnesses on my list, Luke Kendrick and Bryn Ellis. For the first time in my life, I don't know where to begin. I hear a tap on the side of the open door and look up to see Rob standing in my doorway. He smiles and walks right in, taking a seat in the chair in front of my desk. He leans back and crosses his legs, and I feel a rush of desire and fury.
I sent you a picture of our girl last night. She made cupcakes.
Yeah, she likes to bake now, apparently. Taking after your mother.
Hey, I'm not complaining. So what's new with the dead guy?
He says this like he's never met Peter Walsh or his wife Renee Quinn, even though he'd posed in a photo with them. How is it that he thinks he can lie to me so easily? I study him for a tell, a twitch or shift of his body in the chair, but there's nothing. He looks just like my husband, this imposter. I answer with a lie of my own.
I spoke to Renee. Nothing of interest. I was about to write up the report.
Why the hell did she leave the morgue yesterday?
She said she was overcome with grief, wanted to get home to her kids. I asked her to think about who might want to hurt her husband. Gave her the whole speech.
Oh, so you have a speech now for murder cases?
Yeah, I guess I do.
He looks at me, waiting for more. I steady myself, then break the silence by telling him the plan for the day, checking out Peter's search history and phone records to see if we can identify a mistress he was seeing. I say nothing of his searches about Eve Shea. Newport PD is looking deeper into Renee's alibi, speaking to the neighbors, re-interviewing the nanny. There's not much to go on at the moment. But then, he asks me about the one thing I don't want to answer.
Oh, what about the room next door? Did you find the people who stayed there?
I stammer with an answer, a lie, telling him that we have a name and payment method, but that's it. No address or social. He looks surprised. Why is it so hard to find this person? He asks what the name is, and I think I should just tell him, Candace Kane. He won't know the truth, that it was Brooke. And why do I care about lying to him, after he's been lying to me all these years? I'm saved by my phone buzzing. I hold up my hand, telling Rob I need a second, and he gets up, steps outside. Christ. I collapse into the back of my chair as soon as he's gone. Then answer the call from Jamie.
What have you got?
The altered voice. The video you sent me last night? It's a match to Peter Walsh.
And now, we have the identity of the anonymous caller. The one who said that Eve Shea was murdered. Who sent that audio clip of Eve.
Oh, you can't
stop it, guys! I can't swim!
It was Peter Walsh. He had been searching for answers about Eve's death. Renee was telling the truth. I wonder now if he found them. And if that's why he was murdered.
Chapter 34. Brooke, July 3rd, 2025. The message is in my mailbox when I wake up and check my phone. It's from the contact form on my website, the one I use to promote my book. The sender is user 4581@pm.com. I do a quick search. This is Proton Mail, an encrypted service that doesn't require personal information. With Aiden sleeping beside me, I hold my breath as I read the message. They know you were there, Candace. Make it go away. An hour later, I find excuses. It isn't hard. I tell Aiden I need something from the drugstore and he doesn't ask what or why. The escape plan that never gets old. I stop first at the East Bay Luncheonette. Tyler is working the breakfast shift. I sit at the counter with a cup of coffee and wait for him to finish taking an order from a couple dressed in Bermuda shorts and baseball caps. Two eager beavers heading up the coast to the aquarium. They ask Ty for tips on their adventure, and I bite my tongue as I listen to him describe the dolphin exhibit. It isn't exactly SeaWorld. He smiles at them as they study the maps they've pulled up on their phones. Then he walks to stand in front of me. I show him the email, and he tells me what I already know. There's no way he can trace it. He asks me what I'm going to do now. I shake my head over the bitter steam that rises from the ceramic mug, then look at him. And God damn it, it's so hard not to see the scar in the center of his neck, reminding me what our childhood cost him, what Eve's death cost him. I'll figure it out. I've got it.
All right, yeah. Until you don't.
Fear crawls inside me as I drive two blocks to the East Bay police station. I'd already told Carrie that this was how David Paul first communicated with me, emails through my website, which I deleted. She knew I was Candace Kane, the woman who rented the room called Garden 3 at the Four Points Hotel. And once upon a time, she'd been my friend. I have to bring this to her. I need her to help me. I remember the place from 15 years ago when I was asked to answer questions about Eve. First, when she disappeared, and later when she turned up dead. And my story, my lie, was uncovered because of Mr. Rosario pointing the finger at Jeremy and Jeremy caving. I don't check in. I don't need any official records of this visit. Instead, I text Carrie that I'm in the waiting room, then wave off the woman at the counter who asks if I need help. Thanks, but no thanks. I feel her eyes on me until the door opens and Carrie walks out, with her husband, Rob Tremaine. I recognize him from the lawn placards that blanketed the town during the last election cycle. He's more handsome in his picture. They say a quick goodbye. No kiss, no smile. And I feel a wave of panic, wondering if she's told him about me. I turn then, toward the wall, and pretend to be texting on my phone. He walks right by without seeing me. Thank God. Carrie leads me to her office, then closes the door behind us. She doesn't sit, and doesn't invite me to either. We stand face to face, tangled together in the murder investigation of Peter Walsh.
I'm glad you're here. I was gonna ask you to come in.
Why? What's happened?
I need you to look at some pictures. I don't think they're a match, but let's rule it out.
Ah, okay. First, though, I have to show you something.
I pull up the email on my phone and hand it to her. I watch her face contract from all sides as she reads the two lines that sent my heart right through my chest. She hands the phone back and stares at me through squinted eyes.
Who sent this?
I don't know. It could be him.
David Paul?
Yes. Who else?
Why would he do that? He makes it sound like...
I know, like this will fall on me and me alone.
Why would it fall on you if you had nothing to do with Peter Walsh's murder?
Okay, I have to tell you something. You're not gonna like it.
I step away now, thinking about whether I should go on.
Brooke, just tell me.
Okay, I lied about the night Peter Walsh died. David wasn't with me when I heard those sounds coming from the room next door.
What? Brooke!
I know, hear me out.
I walk back to where she stands and take her arms in my hands. I squeeze them hard and look her dead in the eye.
Please, Carrie. I know I've messed up. I always did, didn't I? And you picked up the pieces.
Her face softens, and I think, yes, I found my way through to her. I always could. People don't change. I tell her that David came after I heard the fighting, and when I told him about it, that's when he left to see what had happened. And then he never came back. Carrie nods, taking all of this in. I think we're good now. But then she gets that look, the squinted eyes that search mine for the truth.
Can you answer one question for me?
Anything.
And don't lie to my face this time.
Okay, well, I didn't lie.
Did you know Peter Walsh? He was in East Bay the summer Eve died. They were friends.
What? No, of course not. Don't you think I would have told you?
No, Brooke, I don't.
Chapter 35. Eve. July 4th, 2010. By the time I got to the lawn of the inn, the voices had played out and gone silent. The ocean sounded different here, where the beach ended against a breakwater, slamming against the rocks, pooling on the other side. The water swirled itself into a froth, making the boats rock and the moorings creak. I walked up the lawn to the side entrance, the one that leads to the lowest level of the inn, the basement with the game room, but also in the less appealing part that hadn't been finished for the guests, with the laundry machines for the linens and towels. The heat was almost unbearable in the summer, so Mr. Lowry set up fans and coolers with ice packs that we used to tie around the backs of our necks with the long dish rags from the kitchen. I knew every inch of this place. From work, but also from the adventures I'd had with Brooke and Carrie during the off-season, the memories were woven together in a tapestry that I didn't think I would be able to look at for a long time. I heard voices as I made my way up the slope of the side lawn. I could feel Tyler's eyes on me before I noticed him. He was sitting with the 12-year-old twins, the Granger boys. I forced a smile when I made it to the steps where they were sharing a can of cheap beer. Tyler had been different the past several months. I didn't know why. Maybe he'd just let go of the crush he had on me. I couldn't worry about that now. I had to say a quick hello, then get inside where I could weave my way out to the dock without being seen. So I smiled and asked, "What are you guys up to?"
"Taking a break. I just made the diamond tier. What are you doing here?"
I'm just looking for some friends who said they might be on their boat."
"Whatever."
The other boys looked at each other, not sure what to do about Tyler being so rude. But I was relieved. It meant I could say goodbye and be on my way, which is exactly what I did. I started to walk up the lawn, the slope that leads to the first level and the entrance that was there. Not the front or back, but the side door for employees. I knew the code. From there, I would walk through the kitchen to get to the service doors that opened to the outdoor seating on the deck, and then down the stairs of the back porch to the dock. I was only a few steps away when I heard Tyler, out of breath, calling out,
"Eve, hold up."
And then I felt him grab my arm, but I wasn't having any more of that. I pulled away hard, and he nearly fell to the ground. He started to spill out words, things about being sorry and how it was all Brooke's fault. She made him swear not to tell me, when he's wanted to all year, the reason he got so mad. And then he said the strangest thing.
"I know it's not true, Eve. I know it."
What was he talking about? Was this about Luke? I could see the hurt on his face and his yearning for me to explain myself. What else could he mean? What else does he think I've done? I looked at him, this boy wanting to be a man when he should be out chasing girls his own age, the ones who looked at his thick wavy hair and broad frame and lay in bed at night dreaming of the day they might kiss. But no, he was entangled in my web, the one I never sought to weave. All I could do was stroke his face and tell him I was sorry, then walk away.
Chapter 36. Carrie, July 3rd, 2025. Jeremy Ashbourne left East Bay after the summer Eve died. He didn't return to teaching at the high school. His relationship with Brooke became known to everyone in town, including those on the school board. Even though he and Brooke both claimed nothing happened until after graduation, when Brooke was 18, it didn't matter. It was obvious that something had been developing during the school year, and the connection of that relationship to Eve's disappearance, to her death, was insurmountable. He found refuge north in Warwick, Rhode Island. It was just south of Providence and home to a community college, which was more than happy to boast a professor with a Harvard degree. He taught English there, apparently in a steady state of mediocrity. After 15 years, he didn't have tenure or a department chair position. His career was at a dead end. I drive there after hearing Brooke's confession that she was not with her lover, David Paul, as she listened to the voices and sounds coming from the room next door, where Peter Walsh was likely killed. Then swore again that she didn't know Peter Walsh. She looked at the pictures of over 57 men named David Paul, or some variation of those names, plus a handful of Uber stills showing men getting rides to the Four Points Hotel, and men with royal blue BMWs with RI plates. None of them matched the face of her lover, and she told me she was scared now. If he used a fake name, and if he had sent that email, then what the hell had she gotten herself into? What if he knew Peter Walsh? What if he was setting her up for his murder? Stranger things have happened in the criminal world, but it sounded like a stretch that David Paul would go to all that trouble, and to what end? I believed she was scared. I just didn't know why. I didn't trust her either. And yet I was still helping her, covering her secret for 3 days now, telling myself I would make her come forward as soon as I got the warrant to search the room she stayed in. It still hadn't been approved, and the prosecutor wasn't answering our calls. It wasn't an emergency. I couldn't claim exigent circumstances. I won't lie, though. Rob spent 6 years working in that office before he ran for town council. No. Rob would not do that, would he? Stall a warrant and a homicide investigation? He was in that picture with Eve. Eyes fixed to the lines on the asphalt, I run through the questions in my head. The pieces of information about the night Eve died that only Jeremy Ashbourne might know. His face was among those in the photograph that Renee Walsh had given me. Which means, like my own husband, he knew Peter Walsh and was better friends with Eve than he disclosed. I shut out of my thoughts the fact that Eve never told me about this either. Now, I wanted to know everything about those people. And I wanted to know the truth about Brooke. She lied to me about where she was going the night Eve disappeared. Then she lied to the police until Jeremy outed them. Brooke Lowry was a liar. And here I was risking my career for her. I stop asking why, because the answer is right there, in the memory of that day on the beach, when Eve's body lay in the sand and Brooke fell into my arms. That moment of grief tethered us for life. I didn't tell Jeremy Ashbourne I was coming, but I knew he had no classes for the rest of the afternoon. I drove to his house. It was so close to the airport that you could smell the fumes from the jet fuel and feel the planes shake the ground as they took off and landed. Warwick had 36 acres of beachfront, lovely suburbs where people raised their families, taking their dogs to the parks and shopping at the brand new mall that had gone up. But, like every town, there are places that are less desirable. I have to fight the urge to be pleased that Jeremy lived in one. I see a car pull into his driveway, an old Toyota on its last legs, rust beginning to grow on the tailpipe, a dent in the rear bumper. Poor Jeremy. I give him a few minutes to get settled before I march to the front door and ring the bell. He doesn't recognize me at first, but I know him. Jesus, do I know him. His hairline has receded to a full swath of baldness over the top. But he still wears the rest of it long, hanging down behind his ears and against the back of his neck. And those bright blue eyes that used to devastate Brooke when they found their way to her are now a dull gray. When I say my name and show him my badge, he takes in a gasp of breath, his shoulders straightening, his entire back like a steel beam, bracing himself, because what the hell am I doing here? The student he only ever noticed because of Brooke. But I have a job to do. It doesn't help me if he's defensive. So I smile and ask him how he's been.
Can't complain.
See, you're teaching college now, and Warwick is such a great town. Hey, can I come in?
No one ever thinks to say no in this situation. If they have nothing to hide, they want to clear their names. And if they are hiding, they want to pretend they're not. He does exactly what I know he'll do, stepping aside, letting me pull open the screen door and follow him past a small foyer with a row of worn-out shoes and jackets hanging on hooks. He leads me to a TV room, whose window faces a patch of grass in the backyard, enclosed by a chain-link fence, and a view of the plains so close it looks like we're watching a scene from a movie. He doesn't ask me if I want anything to drink, a cup of coffee, water, but instead splays his legs as he sits on the sofa, resting his elbows on his knees and clasping his hands. He takes on an expression of deep concern, and then he asks me how I've been. He's expecting me to be the girl he knew in high school, the one who always read the room when a teacher was in it, and then gave them exactly what they wanted, obedience. I don't indulge him. I don't tell him one thing about my life. I see his eyes linger on my wedding ring, and then assess me head to toe, making the calculations about my appearance, how I've aged. I can see him wondering who had married me, and I think, this seems exactly right. I pull out the photo that Renee Walsh gave me and place it on the coffee table in front of him. I slide it forward with my index finger and nod toward it, commanding him without one single word to look at the picture. He tilts his head and asks what it is, but then picks up the photo and looks at the faces. Renee Quinn, Peter Walsh, Eve Shea, Rob Tremaine, and himself. He tells me it's a blast from the past, like he's happy to see it. I start from the beginning. I ask him how well he knew these people 15 years ago, and when he asks why this is important now, I tell him to humor me. I expect him to shrug and feed me some bullshit like, I don't really remember, it was so long ago. But he doesn't. He doesn't do that at all. Instead, he sets the photo back down and tells me everything that pops into his head. How he ran into Peter and Renee at a bar one night. He was sitting alone, and they were there with a group of friends. When they found out he was a teacher in East Bay, just 26, fresh off his master's degree at Harvard, they invited him to hang out with them at their house, the one they called Eden, up by the interstate. He says, without any hesitation, that he went there maybe 4 or 5 times, and that, yes, he even went out on the boat with Peter Walsh. He remembers that Peter and Renee were together, but he thought Peter was a bit slimy, are his words. And I shake my head and nod, trying not to convey the deep irony that I feel when he says this. I ask if he thought Peter could have had a relationship with someone else in the house. And he asks me, who? Again, I shrug, trying to pull off nonchalance. I don't know. Would he have been interested in Eve Shea? And now, I watch as his back straightens again, and his face changes to something more serious. And I think, this is the time. I launch in.
Eve Shea, the girl who died?
I don't know. It's possible. Renee would have killed him, though. She seemed pretty aggressive.
Aggressive?
You know, the way girls can get when they have a boyfriend at that age. Possessive.
Did you ever see them alone? Eve and Peter?
Maybe. I honestly don't remember. She seemed pretty close to Renee. Do you think she would do that to her friend? Take her boyfriend? She didn't seem like that kind of girl.
Sounds like you got to know her pretty well, then.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Jeremy holds his hands to the sky and shakes his head. He now knows where I'm headed, and fear has set in, like I've tapped into an old wound, and his brain is slowly remembering how it happened.
No, no way. I did not have a relationship with Eve Shea.
But you had a relationship with Brooke Lowry.
That doesn't mean I was after every high school girl in East Bay. I never hit on you, did I?
There was a reason I was hanging out at Eden House. The only people who lived in town were way too old for me, or...
Too young?
Brooke was 18 when we tried to get together.
What do you mean, tried? You were together the night Eve disappeared.
Is that what she told you?
Mr. Ashbourne, it's in your statement. It's the reason you were fired. And it was your alibi that night?
Jeremy covers his face with his hands. He knows he's backed himself into a corner. I think about the statements that Brooke's father and brother both gave that night. They said Brooke was home just after midnight,
The detectives at the time, and myself later, all concluded that they were lying to protect her, not knowing that she had another alibi. But now, I'm starting to wonder what actually happened between Brooke and Jeremy the night Eve died. My father taught me a lot of things before he died, through the stories he told me about his job, including the way he interviewed witnesses. I've never been in this situation before, but I need Jeremy to tell me the truth about that night, the night he was supposedly with Brooke. So I lie.
Look, relax. Eve's death was solved a long time ago. We know that she drowned accidentally, and we were able to match the DNA of the baby she was carrying. We know it's not yours, and that you had nothing to do with her death. But there are some loose ends, and they have to do with Peter Walsh, so I need to know what really happened that night.
I don't understand. What kind of loose ends? Was Peter the father? Why don't you just ask him?
I catch myself looking at the ground. He doesn't know. Peter Walsh's death hasn't been announced to the public yet. Rob has done a good job of keeping things quiet until after the 4th of July. I take a breath and look Jeremy in the eye.
Just answer the question. We can do it here, or I can bring you to East Bay and do this more formally.
Jeremy leans back against the sofa and lets his arms flop to his sides. He looks like a sad clown with his half-bald head and the hair that falls around it. The man who used to command every classroom with his charisma. Kids are so naive. He tells me how he's always worried that Eve's death was going to come back to haunt him. When I ask him what he's talking about, he finally tells me the story about the night Eve died, the words pouring out of him with waves of relief. How he drove back from Boston as planned, then saw Eve walking along the access road toward the inn. He pulled up beside her, she got inside, and they talked. That was all. She got out and kept walking. Brooke saw them, then ambushed him. After their fight, Brooke drove off, heading home. They never went to his house. Her family wasn't lying after all. She and Jeremy were. And then, he says,
"By the way, have you asked Brooke about Peter Walsh?"
Why?
"Because she knew him. Better than she got to know me, if you know what I'm saying."
Chapter 37. Brooke, July 3rd, 2025. I smile as I walk through the station, out the door, and get in my car. The smile stays on my face until my cheeks begin to cramp and I realize I can let it go. And then I feel my shoulders fall and my chest sink inward, ribs disappearing beneath my dress. "Okay, it's fine," I tell myself as I drive back home. Aiden texted, asking if everything was okay. I'm sure he's wondering how long it takes to buy tampons. I pull over in a church parking lot before I get to the access road. I find a reusable shopping bag in the back of the car, on the floor, and I bring it to the front seat. I open my purse and dig around, finding the hard shell case for my Chanel sunglasses and throw it in the bag. I won't take it out until I'm upstairs, alone. Aiden won't even ask about it. I put the car in reverse and turn my head to pull out of the space. But then I stop, hit the brakes, as a thought flashes through my mind. "Slow down, Brooke," I say out loud. "Slow down." Everything went just fine. I didn't recognize any of the men in the photo array Carrie showed me, but they didn't expect me to. "And now," she said, "they'll try to get the person behind that proton mail message I received. The one that still has my heart racing." But that's not the only thing. I close my eyes and think about senior year, and what I told Eve and Carrie about the summer boy I found to lose my virginity. They knew it was my plan, wanting to avoid the drama that surrounded the event in East Bay. Like somehow every girl who had to come of age here owed this moment to the community. That summer, I knew I was ready, and I was determined to get it done without anyone knowing. No way was I doing it with anyone from our high school class. Look how that turned out for Eve. Poor Eve. I shouldn't think about her that way. The mistakes she made. I mean, Luke Kendrick. When she told me and Carrie that she thought she might like him after all, we warned her. We did. Both of us. And then he pulled that sensitive bullshit on her.
and she fell for it. Even Carrie knew. I remember laughing when she told Eve that all the boys knew this trick, how to stare at us with feigned interest and say things like, "And then what happened?" or "How did you feel about that?" The internet and social media had taught them how to deceive us, gave them the ingredients for our kryptonite, emotional connection. It went both ways. I remember the girls who suddenly found a passion for watching sporting events. They bought t-shirts and hats with team logos, made form-fitting for girls, of course. Some of them even bought underwear. The boys always had hard-ons for girls pretending to be bros. Carrie told Eve all of this, and I laughed but agreed with her. It was true. Luke Kendrick was just trying to wear Eve down with all his talk about his mean father. Boo-hoo, he had to play football. In the end, he got a scholarship to college, which he turned down. I heard he couldn't finish 4 years at Bowdoin, ran out of money, and now he sells life insurance. And what did Eve get? He ruined her relationship with Connor and his family. Maybe she would still be alive if that hadn't happened. Maybe she would have been with Connor that night and not walking alone to the inn. Focus, Brooke. What exactly did I tell them about my summer fling, Carrie and Eve? Did I tell them it was with a boy named Peter Walsh? I told them right after it happened, how I met him at the inn. But what else? I think about that night, how I'd gone out by the dock to smoke a cigarette. My parents would kill me if they saw. I was sitting on the edge between two big boats. One of them was the Granger's. I knew Aiden and his family had gone back to Boston. They would return for one more week, then drive the boat to Madison, where they kept it for the winter. The other was a family I didn't know, but it was dark and late, and they'd fastened the covers. I would be alone there. Or so I thought. Until I heard a voice, and then saw a face coming around the bow of the Granger's boat. Peter said he smelled the smoke and came to find the source. His parents hated it too, and he didn't have his own pack. So we sat there, smoking and talking. And then we sat on his boat, an old Woody in a slip at the end, and drank Jack Daniels and listened to the radio. An hour later, we were kissing, and I thought, this is it. This is the one. It was easy. I just let it happen. Peter threw some seat cushions on the deck, covered them with a tarp. It was stiff and cold against my back when he took off my shirt, so he lay down and pulled me over him. And when I felt him brush against me, I just guided him in while he lay still, his hands on my hips, a smile on his face. It lasted no more than a few minutes, or at least that's how I remember it. I went to the small head and bunched toilet paper into my underwear. We smoked another cigarette, drank a little more, and then I went home. Mission accomplished. Carrie and Eve wanted every detail, but I held back. In truth, I lied. Peter said he had a girlfriend, and I told him I didn't care. But Eve worked at the inn. He was staying there with his parents. Eve might know them or recognize the boat if I described it. It was the only Woody on the dock. Ah, but it was more than that, I remind myself. It's so easy to gloss things over. I didn't want Eve to know anymore because she had grown so close to my father. It makes me sick now to think about how I blamed her when it was his fault. What kind of grown man becomes friends with a teenage girl, a friend of his daughter? And when he knows his wife watches every move and is just looking, just waiting for a reason to set the family on fire. It wasn't just that one time that I heard them fighting about it. Tyler was in that basement so much he was spared, but I had nowhere to go most nights. It would be too late to run to Carrie's again, and after the first time she accused him, there was nothing to tell. There was no reason to run outside in the rain, all the way to the Hollis house and cry to my friend, ask her if she thought it was true, if it could be true.
Why don't you go tell your daughter? Tell everyone how you're fucking Eve Shay!
So, no, I lied to both of them. I told them it was on the beach, in the dunes, and I said his name was Ned something, and that was that. I was so focused on Jeremy the moment school started, we never talked about it again. Okay, I think. My thoughts are together. My memory is clear. No one knew that I'd met Peter Walsh when we were in high school. Except, fuck, I'm now remembering. The one person I hate more than anyone. I can't believe what I have to do. I grab my phone and pull up the number for Jeremy Ashbourne.
Chapter 38. Eve. July 4th, 2010. I left Tyler standing on the lawn and ran to the top of the hill and the service door that opened to the kitchen. I heard him call my name.
Eve!
But I didn't turn around. I punched in the code and pulled on the thick metal handle, feeling it give. Tyler's voice drifted away with the sound of the crashing waves in the distance and the froth swirling against the rocks and the boats. I stepped inside and flipped on the light, letting the door slam close behind me. The kitchen was clean, and the staff was gone for the night. Trays of cocktail glasses from after-hours service sat on one of the long metal counters, waiting to be washed in the morning. I walked past them, and the row of stoves and ovens, the racks of dishes, skillets, and pots on open shelves, then through a set of swinging doors into the dining room. It was dark there, except for the moonlight coming through the glass, floor to ceiling, revealing views of the ocean from three sides. It smelled of the lemon cleaner used on the wood floors, and the residue from the boiling lobsters that had wafted in from the kitchen and clung to the fabric of the chairs and the white tablecloths. I remembered this smell from the first day I started working here. In the middle of the dining room were large sliding doors that opened to the terrace on the patio. I went through them and stepped outside. That was when I heard his cough and the clicking of ice cubes against crystal as he swirled his drink. Mr. Lowry was at a table on the far side, sitting alone in the darkness with his favorite cocktail. An old-fashioned. I could tell by the color and the smell as I walked closer. When he turned his head, he was surprised to see me. He took a long sip of his drink and set it back down on the table. Then he pushed out his chair, got up, and walked to where I was standing. I could only imagine what I looked like by then. The smile on his face was sad, and it reached up to his eyes when he looked at me. I could see the thoughts playing out in his head, the smile growing to concern as he thought about his daughter.
Where's Brooke?
He asked me, and I didn't know what to say. We had both lied, to him and my father, who had gone to bed worried because Mrs. Lowry had told him she'd discovered our plan. But I knew then that she hadn't told her husband. I couldn't lie to Mr. Lowry, not to his face. I told him I didn't know where Brooke was, but that she had plans to meet a friend, and that we had used each other to make a story so we could do other things tonight. He hung his head and gave it a shake. Then a small smile returned to his face. He made a comment about Brooke being 18 now and going off to college in the fall. He said it was silly that he even asked where she was going. Then he said,
"You know how her mother is."
When Mr. Lowry had spoken to me before about his wife, I thought he just needed someone to listen, not to offer advice or tell him he should leave her. Even though I thought it, I saw how much she was hurting Brooke and Tyler. But tonight, he didn't stop there.
"You know, Eve, it isn't right for me to talk to you about these things. And look at you. All grown up, just like Brooke."
I froze, not knowing what to say. He was a handsome man, tall and broad, just like Tyler. And I had always found comfort when I was with him. I wanted that now. Comfort and help. But he wanted something else.
"I've never felt this kind of connection with someone. You're an old soul, Eve Shay."
What was he doing? The ocean crashed against the break front, and we both turned toward the sound. But he quickly looked back, asking if I was all right, because Brooke was with another friend, and I was here, all alone.
"Why are you here, Eve? Did you come to see me?"
He put his hands on my shoulders. He leaned in like he was about to kiss me.
"No! No, stop!"
I took a step back and drew my hands to my face. What is happening? Is this why he'd been so kind to me? Is this what it always came down to between men and women? Mr. Lowry had always been my safe place, and now it was ruined. I started to cry.
"Oh, God, Eve, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
Mr. Lowry pulled me to him, and I pressed my head into his chest. I felt one of his hands hold my back and the other cradle my head, and suddenly I felt like a child in the arms of a father who had never held me this way, or the mother who used to hold me like this, but was now gone. Why couldn't it be that way? I heard him whisper,
"Shh, it's okay now. It's okay.
And then I heard footsteps and felt Mr. Lowry's arms release. I turned to see who was there. The voice, screaming at both of us. It was Tyler.
I knew it!
No! It's not what you think. Tyler!
But it was too late. His son had seen us together, embracing like we were lovers. I looked at Mr. Lowry and saw the bewilderment on his face. He didn't know what to do. He never did. And all I knew was that I couldn't be there for one more second, feeling the hatred from Tyler and the strange longing from this man who wanted to go back in time before his life went down a road he could never turn back from. I already had too much to carry. So I ran across the porch and down the steps toward the dock. I heard Mr. Lowry call after me.
Eve! Wait! Don't go out there alone! It's too rough!
And then Tyler's voice that followed me as I made my way to the dock. Words I knew I would never forget.
You make me sick, Eve Shay. I hope you die.
I got to the bottom of the steps, thinking I was free of them both. But when I looked toward the dock, I saw a figure standing in the dim moonlight. He must have followed me from the arcade after I jumped from the bathroom window, or maybe he'd seen me in Jeremy Ashbourne's car. I thought he'd driven by and gone home. But I was wrong, because now, here he was. Luke Kendrick was here, waiting for me.
Chapter 39. Carrie. July 3rd, 2025. Luke Kendrick lives an hour south of East Bay, just north of New Haven. He sells life insurance, married with three kids. He never finished college or became a history professor, but he has a full life, and it makes me a little angry. As I make the drive from Jeremy Ashbourne's house near the Providence Airport, I still picture Luke Kendrick at our senior prom. Connor was screaming at Eve, calling her horrible names as he stumbled from foot to foot. Luke didn't defend her. Instead, he goaded Connor.
Looks like I win again.
Connor punched him in the face, and they got into it right there on the dance floor, with the music still playing. Poor Eve in her long blue dress that matched Connor's tux, pleading as we pulled her away.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Eve told us a few days later, after the breakup was final and the gossip had died down, how Luke had asked her to leave with him, how he confessed his love for her, and she was going to do it, because there was a part of him she still loved. Brooke and I glanced at each other, because we both knew that there were bigger parts of Luke that would always win out. Eve longed for connections with people. It had to be the loss of her mother that made her that way, and her father being so destroyed by that loss that he didn't know how to show up for her, except to provide, put a roof over her head, move her to a safe town. But kids need more than that. Eve needed more than that. As I near the exit, I think about Jeremy Ashbourne, how he too had grown close to Eve. I knew he had offered to help her with her scholarship applications. Jeremy told me that, in the end, none of the scholarships had come through. He asked her what she was doing in the fall, and when she said she was going to college, he asked her how she had the money. He said she was evasive, saying that she had made some very generous friends that summer. Jeremy pushed her to tell him more. Was it Renee, or Peter, or someone else in the house by the interstate? The college kids who'd come for the summer? And when she wouldn't answer, he said he got frustrated with her. He'd done so much to help her, and he didn't understand why she didn't trust him. He said, in the end, he asked her straight out if she was getting the money from the Rosarios. He was spinning all kinds of ideas and throwing them at her. The one that seemed to anger her the most was when he asked her if she was pregnant and blackmailing the Rosarios. He said he was half joking, but then Eve told him to fuck off, got out of the car, and slammed the door. Jeremy was angry that she wouldn't answer, but now thinking that he had struck a nerve. I've always wondered if Eve knew she was pregnant. It was so early, just 6 weeks, and she had so much going on in her life. It could have been Connor's, The prom was just under 6 weeks from the day she died. But Christ, if she knew, why wouldn't she have told us? Told me, at least. I would have helped her. I get off the exit and follow the GPS to Luke Kendrick's suburban enclave on a lovely cul-de-sac. I park at the curb and check my phone. This day has been long. It's after 6, and I still haven't called Sylvie to see how her day was. She's been home from camp for hours at her father's house. I can't even think about that, still not knowing what my husband was doing in that picture. I tell myself one thing at a time. Peter Walsh was investigating Eve's murder. That's what got him killed. I'm sure of it. And Luke Kendrick may have pieces to the puzzle. His wife answers the door, calls out his name. She invites me in and offers me a glass of wine. I can see the open bottle in the kitchen, next to the glass she's poured for herself. I politely decline, then sit and wait, taking in the designer furniture, the artwork on the walls, the pictures of the children in silver frames on a piano in the corner. When Luke comes into the room, out of breath from playing in the backyard with his kids, he looks happy to see me. He smiles and pulls me in for a hug.
Carrie, Hollis!
Hey.
How the hell have you been?
Suddenly, I feel like I'm at a high school reunion and not interviewing a witness who was once a suspect in Eve's death. He sits across from me in his khaki pants, white button-down shirt, a big smile. He asks me how he can help with an earnest expression, like he means it. I don't recognize the boy he once was in the man he is now. Maybe Brooke and I were wrong about Luke. Maybe it was Eve who was right. He appears genuine. I cut to the chase. I tell him that I have new information about Eve's death, that I'm obligated to close the loop after receiving an anonymous tip.
It's probably nothing, probably kids pulling a prank, but I do need to ask you about it.
I watch his face as I tell him this. I remind him that 15 years ago, he said he spent the night with Bryn Ellis, and she confirmed the story, then and again just now when I called her on the drive. I ask Luke if he remembers this, and he half nods, half shakes his head. I make a comment about how it's not every day that you get interviewed for the murder of a girl you'd known for 4 years. We all remember those weeks the summer Eve died. He wants to know what the new information is. Maybe it will jog his memory. So I tell him.
Someone saw you driving along the access road just after midnight. That wasn't the way home to your house from the pier.
Luke looks to the sky, like he might find the right answer there. And then his eyes grow wide as a memory begins to play. I decide to give it a little jog.
Do you remember blocking Eve from leaving the arcade that night?
Oh, man.
Do you remember following Eve into the arcade, cornering her in the bathroom?
I was so drunk.
Yes or no?
Yeah, I remember.
I give him a moment as he lets this rattle around inside this new person he's become. The things he did that he knows he can't deny. There were multiple witnesses to his behavior at the pier. And then, I stretch the truth just a little.
You were driving toward the inn.
Yeah, that's right. It was in my car, but I wasn't driving it. That girl, Bryn Ellis, she drove. She took us to some dead-end street so we could park.
Leroy Street?
Yeah.
So did you stay there all night?
Right after we got there, I got a text from a kid on the team, a ninth grader. He was in that gaming room with a bunch of other kids, and two of them, these twins, were talking about Tyler Lowry and how he'd gotten into a fight with some girl named Eve.
Why was a ninth grader texting you?
Teammates, you know? They knew all about my beef with Eve.
Your beef? That's what you call it?
When I was a dumb jock in high school, yeah.
Just tell me what happened next.
Nothing. I mean, I walked to the inn to look for her.
You went to the inn?
Yeah, look, I didn't say anything back then because nothing happened. I never saw her.
She wasn't there?
No, not that I saw. And I looked everywhere. Finally, I gave up and went back to the car. Bryn had fallen asleep, so I climbed in the back seat and passed out.
I take a long breath and let this settle in. Luke rambles for a stretch about how sorry he is that he didn't say anything before, 15 years ago. He figured the twins, or Tyler Lowry, would have told the police about seeing her there. And why didn't they? I wonder.
There's no statement by the Granger twins, and Tyler's had nothing about Eve. Then his wife is here, saying it's time for dinner. Can you call the kids? And Luke asks if there's anything else he can help with. So I tell him, look, think about anything else you remember that you didn't share with the police. Like who it was who called you from the game room, what kind of fight they saw or heard. It's important. One of them might have seen Eve at the inn. Of course, I think now. I already know one person who saw her there and who lied about it. Tyler Lowry. We walk to the door, which he opens. He smiles at me and then says,
I know I could have handled things better with Eve, but we were just a bunch of dumb teenagers back then.
Yeah, we were. But Eve always said she saw something in you. Something she loved. Luke's face gets flushed, and he looks like he might cry. His eyes turn to the sky, and he shakes his head.
Man, is that true? She really say that?
Yeah.
Fuck. I wanted to believe that. I couldn't. Kind of broke my heart a little.
You had a strange way of showing it.
I've never loved anyone like that. Not ever.
I stare at him, dumbfounded. Guilty, even, for the things I said to him about Eve. I say goodbye and walk to my car, thinking, who is this man? What happened to the Luke Kendrick I used to know? Maybe there was a small part of him that loved her, and that Eve loved back. And what might have been if he'd taken Eve's hand that night at our senior prom and just ran away with her? We see two of his kids on the lawn, boys who can't be older than 8 and 10. They're throwing a football. I'm not 3 steps off his porch when I hear a voice bellow.
Oh, what the hell was that? You throw like a goddamn girl.
I turn to the lawn and see the face of a young boy quiver as his father marches up to him, grabs him by the shoulders, and gives him a good shake.
You sure you're my son?
And I think, yup, there he is after all.
Chapter 40. Brooke. July 3rd, 2025. It's funny how once you stop wanting a man, he wants you more, and the spell is broken. That's what I think when I call Jeremy Ashbourne from the church parking lot. After our fight the night Eve died, the fight that was about Eve and why he was with her alone in his car when he was supposed to be at his house in his bed with me, our first time together, I went to Brown, and he got that shitty little job nearby in Warwick. When Eve turned up dead, I fell apart. Carrie was the only one who saw it, but she was done with me when she found out I'd lied about where I'd been that night. By the time I got to college, I had become a machine, a fortress built around my heart. I plowed through classes, roommates, friends, taking what I needed. And one thing I needed was to destroy Jeremy Ashbourne. I'd been there maybe 3 weeks when he texted me, and I could feel it pulsing my phone, the way the balance of power had shifted. I responded, making a plan to come to his house in Warwick, and then I fucked him, one time, and in a way he'd never forget. Then I disappeared, not answering his texts or calls, leaving him to wonder if I was ever coming back. I left a little hole in his heart, just like he did to me senior year of high school. I thought of this as part of my emotional escape from East Bay. As I wait for him to answer, filled head to toe with apprehension, I think to myself, look how well that turned out. Jeremy, it's been a while.
Brooke, I can't believe this. I was just about to call you.
Aw, that's so sweet.
I just had a visit from your cop friend, Carrie Hollis.
No. Okay, keep your cool, Brooke. Still minimizing the achievements of the fairer sex, I see. Carrie is chief of police, Jeremy.
Whatever. Brooke, this is serious.
Okay. What happened?
Jeremy tells me about the visit, how he confessed to Carrie that we didn't actually spend the night together. He swears he didn't have a choice. I want to climb through the invisible phone line and strangle him with it, but I pretend it doesn't bother me. How stupid he is. I also feel a wave of pride that Carrie Hollis had outsmarted him, and that she'd finally learned the art of deception. I say nothing as he rambles, until he gets to the end, where he talks about Peter Walsh and the connection Carrie has made,
how she showed him a photo of Eve with Peter, his future wife Renee, himself, and some other guy named Rob, who Carrie seemed to know. And that's when I stop him.
Wait, Rob Tremaine?
I don't know, Brooke. It was a long time ago. What does it matter?
Just keep going.
He tells me next about the Eden house and that he didn't think Eve was more than friends with Peter, and then drops the bomb that he told Carrie another truth about that night, how he saw Eve walking toward the inn and stopped to see if she needed help, and that I saw them and we fought and I went home. Those last words reverberate between my ears. He told Carrie the truth, and now she knows I lied about Eve's death twice that summer. That's a big hole to climb out of, especially with a person like Carrie.
Did you ask her why she cared about this old photo with Peter Walsh?
She wanted to know if Eve knew him. I don't know.
Well, she told me the case was closed. So then why would she care about that?
I told her she should ask him about that picture.
Peter Walsh is dead, you fucking idiot! He's dead, and it has something to do with Eve.
She lied to me?
The cops lied to get you to talk? Shocker!
Then I get to the main event, the one thing I have to know.
Jeremy, this is important. When you talked to the police 15 years ago, did you tell them I slept with Peter? Or that I even knew Peter?
No, they never asked me about that.
I exhale, feeling the relief wash in. And then I have a terrible thought that washes it right away.
Wait. Did she ask you about that today? Did she?
She asked me, but I lied. How stupid do you think I am?
Okay. Okay, good.
We sit in silence, both of us absorbing what's just happened and what it means now. Jeremy will likely go about his merry way as he always does, but me? Carrie knows I lied to the police and never said it straight. Not even now, after she's been back in touch and investigating that night all over again. I begin to make a list of the excuses I'll use when I ask her to keep my secret just a little longer and to help me figure out who sent that ominous email. But first, I need to wrap things up with Jeremy. I feel like I'm forgetting something. Carrie's become quite clever since high school.
Okay, is there anything else you talked about? Anything you told her about anyone we knew back then?
No, I don't want to stir up trouble.
Trouble? For who?
Mrs. Rosario, Connor's mom. Didn't I tell you what Eve said that night? Oh, right, you were too busy telling me to go fuck myself in the middle of the street.
Okay, well, we're not in the middle of the street now. What did Eve tell you about Mrs. Rosario?
Chapter 41. Eve. July 4th, 2010. Luke Kendrick. He was hard to miss standing at the edge of the dock, looking out at the boats rocking in their slips. Hands limp at his sides, his head hanging down. Nothing like he'd been earlier when he'd blocked my way at the arcade and then trapped me in the bathroom with a group of his friends. But then I remembered him standing just like that when we took a break from work one day, in that very spot. He'd wanted to go for a swim, and it caught me off guard. I told him I didn't have my suit, and he said I should grab one from the lost and found. There were a dozen in the plastic bin.
Come on, let's do it.
It was so hot, and we had an hour before the dinner shift. And yet...
I don't know how to swim.
It's a date, then.
What is?
I'm gonna teach you this summer.
I had to stop doing this, remembering the Luke I thought I loved.